So just to be aware, we're not going to cover everything that's in the text this morning, but we are going to cover something very important in it. Recently, an advertisement for Coca-Cola caught my eye. We all know that there are next to zero health benefits in drinking Coke. And yet, the advertisement makes you feel as though everyone who drinks Coke have these larger-than-life, happy and fulfilled lives. They have the bubbly friendships and they have a great nightlife and you are socially vibrant and you are smiling and you are embracing a carefree and easy life. And it's this dreamy life that is sealed with slogans like this: come alive with Coke. Things go better with Coke. Open Coke, open happiness. Or just simply life. Life. Selling the idea that life can be made easier by consuming Coke. It got me thinking that sometimes we approach God this way too. We approach God like we approach Coke. Particularly, we sometimes think if we dabble in a little bit of religion, if we consume a little bit of God's blessing, we too will have something of a life resembling Coca-Cola advertisements. And this morning, I'm going to cut it straight with you. I'm telling you, if that's the way we approach God and assume about God's blessing, we're wrong. That is not what you're going to find in Christianity. Consuming a little bit of God is not going to make your life easier. Bear with me. A missionary who I greatly admire has been serving one of the poorest countries in Africa for the past 2 decades. And he often travels to Western churches where he raises his support. But in those churches, he makes this following observation. He notes that Western Christians, these are people like us, right, who live in the Western world, we often make an assumption about Jesus. When Jesus says, "I came that they may have life and have it abundantly," we often assume by abundant, Jesus has something in mind like a Coca-Cola lifestyle for his followers. That's what we assume abundance means. A life of bubbly friendships, a great nightlife, socially vibrant, smiling, embracing a carefree and easy life. We assume all of that when we hear Jesus say that I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. We assume that is Jesus' intentions for us. But this missionary, after decades of preaching Jesus in the poorest, one of the poorest countries on the face of the earth, he says that the abundant life that Jesus promises is nowhere near synonymous with our Western assumptions of abundance. He explains. Since many people's highest aspirations seem to be to arrive safely at death. And Jesus' promise of John 10:10 of life abundant is to be claimed and to be appropriated. And following Jesus is not safe. As a colleague of mine once turned to me with a glint in his eye as we drove along roads fraught with danger, he said, "Simon, isn't this exciting? We're immortal until God calls us home." Particularly from 1999 to 2003, I lived expecting to die. As I drove each weekend along deserted roads, anticipating deadly ambushes, completely ready to die, I never felt more alive. One time, 40 people were killed, but we got through. Another time, I ate Chinese takeaway, and I heard 3 shots and found out later my friend had been murdered. And he counts this among life abundant. So when we read these raw and gritty testimony of those who follow Jesus, it's very hard to press Jesus' promise of an abundant life into our assumptions that blessing from God means a lifestyle resembling a Coca-Cola advertisement. It's very hard when the raw realities of life point a very different picture of what it means to follow Jesus. So what I'm getting at is this. If we assume that blessing from God always means an easier life, we're wrong. In fact, sometimes we receive blessing from God which actually makes life more difficult. So let's trace that in the passage before us this morning. Jacob is up against some serious trouble in his life. He's just acrimoniously severed his relationship with his uncle, and he's returning to a homeland which he once fled because of a death threat that hung over his life from his brother. So, Jacob's in a bit of a pinch. He's got a bad relationship behind him and a potentially deadly one in front of him. And he knows it. Verses 6 through to 7, Jacob sends these messengers ahead of him to test the waters with his brothers, right? Go on ahead and just see what Esau's like. Is he still bitter as? Is he still bent out of shape because of what I did to him all those years ago? And the messengers come back to Jacob with this message. They come back, "We came to your brother Esau, and he is coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him." Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. All that that's telling us, it's probably not a good sign when the brother who threatened to kill you sends a welcoming party of 400 men. That sounds more like confrontation than reconciliation. So Jacob turns his hope for blessing of deliverance to God. Where else could he look? 400 men are coming to welcome him. Where else is his hope going to be? Which brings us to Jacob's prayer, and what a remarkable prayer that is. I invite you to read it again later today and learn something from that about what it's like to cast yourself so fully on God the way that Jacob did, the way that he cast himself on God to care for him in his difficult situation. And in the prayer, Jacob recalls God's faithfulness. "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac." And he recalls that God has given him a command. He has taught him to obey and said, "You said to me, return to your country and your kindred that I may do you good." And then Jacob recalls his lack of entitlement to any of the good promises of God. He says, "I'm not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown your servant." And he recalls and he pleads for a blessing from God. "Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau." And then lastly, he confesses his fear. "I fear him, that he may come and attack me and the mothers with the children." That's a great model for our prayers, I think. To recall God's faithfulness and recall what he has commanded you to do, to confess that you are not entitled to the goodness of God in your life, and then plead for his blessing and confess the things that you fear and the things that burden your heart. you can model your prayer on that. But what I want to point out this morning is how Jacob utterly throws himself on God for help. He knows he's got so little chance against Esau, his brother, without God on his side. So he wants to get his hands on God's blessing. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother. He wants his hands on God's blessing. And yet, as we see Jacob pleading with God for blessing and for deliverance and for refuge from this difficult situation in front of him, he stitches together a couple of plans in case things go badly. He divides his entourage, his whole people that were with him, all the servants, everything that he's got, he divides it into two groups in the hope that, hey, look, if Esau attacks one group, at least the other will have a chance of escape. And then he sends wave after wave of gifts to his brother Esau, right, to try and placate any lingering anger that he might have. And he says, I'm doing this that I may appease him with the present that goes ahead of me. Perhaps he will accept me. So he's making these plans to, just in case Esau is still bent out of shape because I stole his birthright and the family inheritance, maybe he will be appeased through all these gifts. So on the one hand, Jacob is driven rightly into God's arms for desperation and help for the situation in front of him. And on the other hand, he is making plans, trying to figure out how to get out of this in case things go badly. What do we make of this oscillation between dependence and trust on God and also making these practical plans to escape should things go badly? Well, there's no clear answer here, but there are a couple of things we could say. There's no clear answer because the text itself doesn't elaborate for us. It neither calls this faithfulness or unfaithfulness on Jacob's part. It just tells us what he did. So I guess in one way we could say that maybe it is a sign of wavering faith. Maybe he didn't trust God enough, and that's why he was making these plans in case things didn't work out as he had hoped. So it may be a sign of wavering faith, trying to exert control over a situation. And we know that that happens. Many of us who have prayed desperately for God's help in our most difficult seasons knows what this is like. We know it intimately. We know how our minds and our hands busy themselves to try and control a situation we have just entrusted to God in prayer. We're wrestling for control with God, and so we make plans. And maybe this is what Jacob was doing. We don't know for sure. It may not be a wavering of faith on Jacob's part. Making plans is not always a sign of wavering faith. It could be wisdom. It could be wisdom. You see, trusting God is not an excuse for sitting on our hands and doing nothing. For instance, I pray that the Lord would keep my family safe at night, but I still lock my doors and close my windows. Does that mean I'm not trusting God enough? Because I avail myself to practical wisdom like a locked door and a closed window. Sometimes it's just wise, isn't it? to avail yourself to the practical things that you can do. And this is perhaps what Jacob was doing, availing himself to the wise plans that he has given the situation at hand. Either way, Esau and his 400 men welcoming party is still coming. Plan or no plan, 400 men are coming your way. And Jacob needs deliverance by getting his hands on God's blessing. And this is the direction that our passage now takes us in. And it's also the part of the story where things get a little mysterious. They do. At one moment, Jacob continues his journey towards his home country. And the very next, verse 24, Jacob was left alone and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. There's virtually no transition between that. He goes and he makes sure that his kids and so on are crossing the river safely. The next, he's alone wrestling a man. The transition is so sharp. And this wrestling encounter imposes itself on us. We're meant to just be confronted with it immediately this way. And yet it is so, so mysterious how this episode exerts itself on us. The man is simply introduced as a man. There's a guy wrestling Jacob, getting mano a mano with no name. What's that? He has no name. He is just introduced as a man. And then as we read, we find that this man possesses an uncommon power. He is able to put Jacob's hip out of joint with a mere touch. Right, he didn't climb to the top rope of the tent and like elbow drop him. It was just a touch. And in the midst of this, we have this memorable petition of Jacob, right? I will not let you go unless you bless me. And it shows Jacob's desperation for God's deliverance. And blessing Jacob did receive. But not blessing as we might expect. Let's take a close look at this blessing that Jacob received. Firstly, the blessing consists in Jacob having his name changed. You'll find that in verse 28. He has his name changed by this mysterious wrestler from Jacob, which had now up to this point meant heel grabber or deceiver as a verbal description of his life, to Israel, which is indicative of this wrestling with God, which is what Israel means, this wrestling or striving with God. And that is real blessing, to have your name changed by God to something far more fitting and descriptive of what your life will now become. It shapes and it claims a new identity for the sojourner formerly known as Jacob, because by naming him, God claims Jacob for himself. As God said through the prophet Isaiah, O Israel, I have called you by name, you are mine. To be named by God is to be claimed by God. That is blessing aplenty. And though that is true blessing, that is something to be profoundly thankful of in this life, to be claimed so intimately by God for God. God's blessing also makes Jacob's life a whole lot harder. How so? Well, the name change is not the only thing Jacob received that night, is it? He was also afflicted with a physical disability. Verse 25, this man touched his hip socket and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. So Jacob was afflicted with a physical disability, making his life much, much harder than what it already was. And to think of this, to think of a physical disability, to think of Jacob having his hip put out of joint, to think of that as blessing makes almost no sense for those of us who assume that blessing from God always means an easier life. Moreover, if we assume blessing from God is supposed to make life easier, we would think that perhaps if God was going to bless Jacob, he should give him superpowers, not wound him. Give him superpowers, make him a comic book figure. Give him laser beam eyes or something so that he can destroy 400 people. That'll be blessing. So a disabling injury makes little sense as a sign of God's blessing for those of us who assume that blessing always means an easier life. And so this disabling injury makes Jacob's life harder than what it already had been. Because see now, Esau with his encroaching 400 men, Jacob can't even run away. His leg's stuffed. He can't even just jump on a horse. His leg is stuffed. He is going nowhere in a hurry and there are 400 men marching towards him. His life is made harder because of his encounter with God. Much more precarious. So, his encounter with God has made his life a whole lot harder, a whole lot more precarious rather than easier and carefree. And yet I maintain this is still part of Jacob's true encounter with God and part of his experience of God's blessing. I will say more of this when I conclude the sermon in 2 weeks' time, how this physical disability actually turns out to be a profound blessing in his life. But let me just close with the point that I had set out to make today. If we assume God's blessing means an easier life, we're wrong. Be careful what you assume blessing from God means. Be careful what you assume when Jesus says, "I have come to give them life and life abundant." What you mean by abundance and what Jesus means by abundance may be two very different things. Jesus may mean the abundance of tears for facing life with all its misery that we have to face it with. So be careful what you assume when you think about being blessed by God. Sometimes blessing on the face of it makes situations harder than what they already are. And yet in time, the abundant life as Jesus defines it will emerge from your hardship and you will recognize the flowering of your hardship as a blessing from God. Which now leaves us with this question. If this is what Jesus offers, not always an easier life, will believing, trusting and following him still hold your attention? Do you still want him? Do Do you still want to follow Jesus if that's what he means? When following him means giving up on the dream of a life which resembles a Coca-Cola advertisement. I ask you this because Jesus plainly said to his followers, the gate is narrow and the way is hard. Mark that, it is hard that leads to life. And those who find it are few. Will you follow this Jesus? I'm going to leave you pondering that question. Being a follower of Jesus is no guarantee of an easier life. In fact, it most likely means a more difficult one. But will you, like his earliest disciples, still follow him, knowing that we have no other Savior to go to and nowhere else to find the words of eternal life?